game.
To Shattering Myths. In our second hour, we're going to continue on the same topic as promised earlier. But we are going to turn our attention, turn the page, if you will, to Zechariah, who actually was not a prophet. He, like Yirmiyahu, was simply a scribe. He wrote down what Yahweh said in first person. So this testimony is directly from the Creator God of the universe, so it is reliable. God has had this tendency to be accurate on 100% of his predictions, never gotten one wrong. Now, we can give God a lot of credit and say he's a really, really good prophet, or we can acknowledge the reality that he's not a prophet at all. You see, God has already witnessed our future because he can witness our past, present, and future simultaneously. He's simply reporting in our past what he has already seen. There is a earthquake which is unleashes a considerable amount of energy upon Yahusha's presence when he returns. It is recorded in all three of Revelation's final judgments. It is also discussed in Zechariah. This is chapter 4:14, the fourth verse. And the Mount of Olives will split into two, down the middle, from the east gate to the sea, exerting great force. Half of the mountain will be felt moving southward, and half will move north, creating a great valley. God then says, escape to safety. By the way, so that you know, right behind the Mount of Olives is probably the greatest gorge on the earth. It's a fault line. It is the fault line that goes all the way from the Great Rift Valley that goes through the Middle East and all the way down through Africa. And it is an earthquake fault line. Escape to safety through my mountain valley, for indeed the mountain valley will reach the place where you will be set apart and taken away. Depart in haste, similarly to how you fled from the presence of the earthquake in the days of King Uzziah of Yehuda. So that's the declaration of the earthquake that is going to occur simultaneous with Yahusha's return. The next verse is also cited in his Olivet Discourse, where Yahusha speaks of this earthquake. And Yahweh, my God, will return, and all of those who are set apart with him. This explains a very often misunderstood passage where God is talking about when he returns, that the souls of those who are set apart will come with him. These are not raptured souls. These aren't people who are plucked from various places in the earth. No, these people who are set apart are those who were harvested by God prior to his return and are now coming back from exploring the vast reaches of the universe. So he says, he will send forth his messengers with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his chosen from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other extreme. That is Yahusha's statement in Matanyah, speaking of the same event. Many people misconstrue this account, errantly associating it with the rapture, which is a Pauline myth, and thereby concluding that the promised event will coincide with the Messiah's return. But that's not what these words say. The chosen are spiritual souls gathered from one end of the universe to the other, not mortals from terrestrial earth. The eklektos in Greek, the kadosim in Hebrew, are called from heaven. For the past decade or so, these previously harvested souls have been out exploring the far corners of the universe. But now, on Yom Kippurim, in 2033, which is year 6000 Yah, we will be summoned to witness the most awesome day in human history. In Zechariah's rendition, Kodos, the singular of Kadosim, is usually translated holy, but that religious term is only accurate so long as it is defined to mean set apart from this world and unto God. But based upon Kodesh, meaning set apart and purified, Kadosh is related to Kadash, meaning to kindle a fire which provides light. Then we read, turning back to Yahweh's testimony in Zechariah. Zechariah means remember Yahweh. This shall come to pass on a day in which there shall not be a diminishing of his esteemed and beloved light. Okay, God says that he is light. That doesn't mean that God is nothing but light. It means that if you want to understand the nature of God himself, the single thing in our universe that is most similar to him would be light. You know, it's a pure form of energy. It has many valuable properties, including making it possible for us to be observant. It makes it possible for us to see. It is the that which illuminates. It's also the source of warmth, and without the light of the sun, there would be no life. And so he's saying that when he returns, there will be no diminishment of his esteemed light, which means he's coming back undiminished. This is an extraordinary statement. God is revealing that he will return without dialing down his power. Since a creator is greater than his creation, considering the size of the universe, that's hard to fathom the scope of this potential energy. But this I know, everyone not enveloped in Yahweh's set-apart spirit will be instantly incinerated by this, vaporized. The spirit is our only protection. Kafaon, the operative word in this passage, could easily have been translated make rigid, fixed, or immobile, had it not been used in conjunction with or light. In relation to other substances, Kapaon communicates the solidification of something from a fluid to a solid. But when associated with light, Kapaon always means to diminish. This is consistent with nature. As matter is transformed from a gas to a liquid, and then from a liquid to a solid state, every substance other than water diminishes in volume. Since the solidification of light is an obscure concept, the related idea of diminishment applies. But, in a very real sense, when God, who is energy and light, takes on a corporeal or physical form, he is in fact diminishing the volume, the mass, if you will, of his nature. You know, E equals MC squared means that matter and light, energy and matter are the same thing, but they're not equivalent. You have to dial one down to get the other. So Yahusha, the diminished corporal manifestation of God, is the solidification of Yahweh, who describes himself as light. So we may be witnessing the personification of light on this day. Now, most English translations, like the English Standard Version and the New International Version, render the passage, on that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost. In so doing, they ignore the first use of Haya, as well as Hu, Ha, and Yakar. Then they render Kipon as cold or frost. The New American Standard writes, and it will come about in that day that there will be no light, the luminaries will dwindle. The King James Version says, and it shall come to pass on that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark. It's little wonder Christians remain oblivious to the day that Yahusha will return. God told us they don't want to hear
it. Aren't they even saying, I mean, in a terrible way, but aren't they saying the same thing Malachi said, the same thing that Zechariah says, that it's going to be dusk because all Moed Mikra started dusk. I mean, there's not going to be any day, there's not going to be any night. That's dusk.
Yeah, the time of his return is quantified as two different things. One is, you just look at the Hebrew calendar, it begins as the sun sets. So that's dusk, and he's going to be providing the light. And the second aspect is that during the last days, throughout Yah's prophetic testimony, he tells us that there are going to be significant signs in the sky that the earth is going to be darkened. It's a combination, I think, of a number of things. One is the asteroid strike. Another is the volcanic action that causes the tsunami. Another is the fallout from nuclear holocaust. But when he returns, we're not going to be able, the sky will be so obscured, you're not going to be seeing the sun, you're not going to see the moon. And so that could also be germane to this. So as we have mentioned, Yahweh associates himself with light. That is why in Matanyah 24:27, Yahusha explained that he will be seen as light upon his return. Therefore, in all those pictures that show him returning to the Mount of Olives, and he just looks like, you know, an ordinary guy, although flying without wings, and a pretty robe. Now, he says, I'm coming back in light. This is his testimony. He says, behold, I have told you in advance. For just as a brilliant shining constellation, rising as a star in the east, to bring forth light, causing it to shine brilliantly and resplendently to the far extent of the setting sun in the west, so in this same manner shall the presence of the Son of Man be. That's right. He's saying, I'm going to return as brilliant as a constellation, as a group of stars. He is not going to come back looking like an ordinary fellow.
Isn't that exactly what he also says in Malachi?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he says, and I'm going to be light, and then the people melt.
Yeah. Right.
And then everybody, you know what everybody thinks there, don't you, Yana?
Yeah, that's also in Zechariah when he says that upon his return, the those who have come to oppose him and his people will will simply disintegrate. It's just like if you were to shine a laser on something, it evaporates. That's what he says that his return is going to do, though.
But you know what everybody thinks. Because they're not catching the diminished, you know, that where you call an extraordinary statement there is an extraordinary statement. I'm going to come back, you know, undiminished. I'm going to come back in full force. That means he comes back as light. It's described as light. Then these people melt. And, you know, people say, well, that's a nuclear war, I think they're talking about there.
No, then their God is a nuclear warhead. And they would then have a problem that they're going to have to deal with on that. We're going to return to our discussion of Zechariah and the predictions therein on Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. Discussion of what's going to occur on our immediate horizon as we project just 21 years into our future, the day that Yahusha will return. But he is returning as Yahweh, undiminished. In each of his six previous appearances, Yahusha arrived as a diminished representation of Yahweh. That is to say, with the exception of the Mount of Transfiguration episode, he appeared as a man rather than as light. To keep from incinerating mortal souls, he reduced his energy to the level we could productively experience. However, upon his final arrival, there will be no reason to reduce the amperage. All surviving Yehudim will be enveloped in his set-apart spirit's garment of light, as will be whatever percentage of what's called the Laodicean assembly that will come to know Yah. And thus, these souls will be unharmed. At the same time, all of those who came to savage Israel, they're going to be annihilated, fulfilling this Mikra, and the prophecy, the Mikra of Yom Kippurim, says that those that don't answer Yah's invitation will be annihilated. And this particular prophet through Yahweh reports that they will be incinerated upon his return. Also keep in mind that matter is simply organized energy or light in a diminished state. That is why it has to be multiplied by the square of the speed of light to determine its quotient of energy. So anything Yahweh takes, any time he takes on a material form, a human form, he has to reduce some aspect of his nature. But this time, during his seventh and final visit, God is going to be more light than matter, and perhaps all energy and thus spirit. Revealing the timing of his return, God inspired Zechariah to write something which unlocks the mystery of no one knows. He says, "It shall be the one day he becomes known according to Yahweh. It shall exist as Haya, the one, the only, the exclusive, the unique, the certain and explicit day. He becomes known, Yada, personally revealed and respected, understood and acknowledged, distinguished and discerned, according to Yahweh." Even law can also mean, and does in most cases, to approach Yahweh. "And it shall be known as the one day which is known to approach Yahweh." Which day do we approach Yahweh? You take the seven Moed Mikre. There are the 7 days that are essential on Yah's calendar. First day is the doorway. It's called Passover. It's the doorway to eternal life. The second one is Matzah, unleavened bread, where it's the threshold of heaven, where our souls are scrubbed of the fungus of sin. The third is our adoption on Bukurim, where we are adopted into God's family. The fourth is seven Shabbat, where the promise of the covenants is materialized, and we become enriched by His teaching, His Torah, and we become empowered by His Spirit. The fifth is Teruah, where those so empowered, those so adopted, those cleansed, are asked to be witnesses, to shout out a warning that there's only one path to God and this is it, and also to tell people the good news that God has a means to approach Him. Yom Kippurim is that day. It is the day that is known, that exists as the one, the exclusive, unique, and certain day which we can't approach Yahweh. We're asked, we're invited, we're summoned to come into the presence of Yah's light on this day. And why? So that we can camp out with Him. So it is the one day that not only can be known, is known to approach Yahweh. Yada becomes known in this passage, tells us that Yahweh will personally reveal Himself on this day and reveal to us the importance of this day, returning as brilliant as the sun, telling us that He's going to do it on the one day of the seven Moed Mikre that is specifically designed for us to approach Him, to come into His presence, for us to respond and answer the invitation. Returning as brilliant as the sun, He will be acknowledged and understood by everyone. There'll be no mistaking Him this time. But more than that, by using the phrase, "It shall be the one, the certain, the unique day," He becomes Yada, personally known. We have yet another affirmation that Yahweh's return is tied to the day man's relationship with God is reconciled. The day of reconciliations. The very day that we're invited and welcomed into His presence. By using Echad, Yahweh is telling us that there is something very special, something singular and unique about the timing of His return. In all of time, there is only one day which meets His requirement. Of that we can be certain. So these things known, while there are these seven special days, only one of them exists as an invitation to come into His presence. And that is the day He is going to return. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. With this segment, what I'd like to do is to tie everything together. We have read now that God told us that there would be earthquakes and massive storms that would increase in frequency and intensity like birth pangs during the last days. So we know what's going to occur. What we're now looking for is when it's going to occur. Now, the last days might sound like, well, that tells us when, but you need to go deeper than that. The last days are the last days on earth prior to His return. So what we're doing now is looking at when He's going to return. We've now isolated the day. He's going to return on Yom Kippurim. And now all we need to do is think it through and say, okay, what year on Yom Kippurim is he going to return? Can we deduce this from the evidence that has been given to us? And indeed, we can. Now, you can deduce it from reading the Bereshit, just the opening chapter of Bereshit, on the 6+1 creation account, where God did all the work necessary, which he talked about, you know, completing his work in 6 days, and on the seventh he rested. Just as there will be 6,000 years of mankind from the time we emerge from the Garden of Eden to the time that Yahweh will return, and we will all rest together and celebrate a final Shabbat in his presence. So everything in Scripture points to this pattern of six, which is the number of man conceived on the sixth day, plus God, who is one, equals seven, which is not only perfection, but God's promise, his plan. We're even told that a day is like 1,000 years to Yahweh. It's all laid out in the Genesis account. Between the genealogies revealed in Scripture, history and archaeology, we know that Adam was cast out of the garden in the neighborhood of 4,000 BCE. In fact, Sir Isaac Newton spent most of his time researching this because he realized this 6+1 pattern and wanted to know when the last day was going to occur. And he came actually within a matter of very few years of approximating the date. Now, but knowing Yah's penchant for precision, I'd bank on the fact that it was 3968 BCE that Adam and Chawa were booted from the garden. The deluge of Noah's day flooded the region of the world in which men with a nesalma, or conscience, lived in the vicinity of 2968 BCE, 1,000 years later. In fact, the Burkle Crater, which is a subject that we will come to before too much time, proves that this area was flooded exactly as God said it was flooded, with the impact of a comet triggering the flood on 2968 BCE. This date is affirmed in many, many places, but the crater off the Indian Ocean off the coast of Madagascar is irrefutable evidence. The covenant was confirmed with Abraham on Mount Moriah, 40 Yobel, which is 50-year period, signifying the Lamb's redemption, after man's fall from the garden in 1968 BCE. So if you go 40 Yobel from 3968, when we can deduce that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden exactly 40 Yobel thereafter in 1968 BCE is when Abraham and Yitzhak enacted the dress rehearsal for Passover and affirmed the covenant. We know with great precision that in 968 BCE, 1,000 years later, Solomon built Yahweh's temple on Mount Moriah, as a symbol of that very covenant. Then, exactly 40 Yobel after Abraham's prophetic dress rehearsal, the Maaseh Yahusha fulfilled the Mikre of Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits in 33 CE. That would have been year 4000 Yah. That same Yobel year, the fourth Mikra, seven sevens was fulfilled on exactly the right date, further establishing God's pattern, his work. Now, then, the waters under the temple were poisoned in 1033 CE, reflecting the Numbers 5 divorce decree from the Torah. Everything now following the same pattern. In Matanyah, Matthew 24, Yahweh told us that the generation which witnesses some rather significant signs, most of which are tellingly referred to as birth pangs, will also experience his return. This list included a world war, of which World War II is the only viable candidate, rumors of war manifest in today's mythical war on terrorism, major tsunamis, large earthquakes, and supersized hurricanes and tornadoes, all of which are increasing in scale and frequency over the past 50 years, pandemics and famines, Both are imminent and unavoidable. Global acts of terrorism, which is Islam's signature act. Worldwide deception, already rampant in academia, politics, religion, and the media, which is why we're on this particular subject. The return of Israel to the land, making it bud and grow again, which occurred in 1948 when the state was reestablished and the new state began to flourish agriculturally, and in 1968 when Jerusalem was reclaimed following the Six-Day War. The rise of anti-Semitism, which leads to the death of many Jews, this too is occurring on an unprecedented rate. And in addition to those things, preaching and healing and the beneficial message, which is the Torah's message, will be disseminated to the world, which is happening by this program and by others who are speaking on behalf of Yah's teaching. There will also be an onslaught of false prophets and wannabe Masayas. One of those, of course, is the current president of the United States. The list here is too long to name, however. It being a bad time to have children, and the start of the tribulation which nearly wipes out all life on earth, the darkening of the sun is a result of an asteroid strike and Daniel's abomination of desolation, all listed earlier in Matanyah's testimony, reflecting what Yahusha had to tell us. God even adds a reference to Yehudim fleeing to the mountains, a citation, of course, of Zechariah 14:5, which we have just considered. The clock on this generation, which witnesses all of these events that Yahweh and Yahusha told us about, began ticking between 1939 and 1948, World War II. Today, there is but one Yobel remaining within the lifespan of that generation, which we were told that generation would witness his return. The lone Yobel remaining within the lifetime of that generation on our pagan calendars is 2033. Just happens to be your 6,000 Yah. Just happens to be exactly 40 Yobel since 33 CE, year 4,000 Yah, when Yahusha, God corporeal, fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukkurim, and Shavuah. The Mikra fulfillments, each on this same schedule. And as you know, 40 is the scriptural number for the completion of a time of testing. Moreover, 2033 will mark 6,000 years since the fall, when redemption's calendar started, counting down the days to reconciliation. Then the final 1,000-year period begins, 5 days after Yah's return as light, on the seventh Mikra, the feast of Sukkah, shelters or tabernacles, in which God camps out with mankind for a millennium. It's all laid out for us. It's easy for us to understand. Therefore, we can deduce that this one exclusive, unique, and certain day in which Yahweh will become known and that we can approach him is Yom Kippurim in year 6,000 Yah, which is October 2nd at sunset in 2033. So yes, God not only knows the day he's going to return, he made it possible for us to discern this date from his word. And from that, all we have to do is deduce what would comprise the last days, knowing that there's only 21 years that remain. 7 of those years will be a horrible tribulation. You know, converted into our pagan Gregorian calendar, his arrival will fall between sunset on October 2nd, Monday, October, and Monday, October 3rd, 2033 at sundown. But Yahweh himself reveals the exact time, and so we don't even have to wonder, will it be at sunset on the 2nd or before sundown on the 3rd? Well, I think this is all clear, at least up to this point. There may be more to this passage than meets the eye. There is a hint in Yahweh's statement that helps us unravel an enormous mystery. But to put the pieces in place, we must first understand that every day, from the beginning to end of time as we know it, is known by God. The day he will arrive in power and glory obviously isn't the one and only day he knows. Last time I checked, he was personally involved in the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkurim in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. And while I think we have discerned what he meant, the question remains, why did God share this with us in this way? by comparing this intriguing verse with the parallel passage in Matanyah, Matthew 24, we are required to do some serious thinking. Let's begin that process by reviewing this portion of the Olivet Discourse in context, confirming what I've just shared with you. But before we begin, remember, Yahusha's next statement follows the list of signs we just delineated. That whole list of things that's going to happen, including this birth pang of storms and earthquakes that are going to besiege the planet, all of this follows that statement. So too, when you see all of these things, including the increase in the power and frequency of earthquakes and tsunamis and tornadoes and hurricanes, the world war, the rumors of war, the increased acts of terrorism, the rise of false prophets, recognize that I am near and nigh, and indeed at the threshold. Indeed, I say this is sure and true. This generation will not pass away until all of these things take place, including his return. Those who are witnessing this increase in storms, this climate change, are also going to see his return. Since one of these things was a world war, for this to be true, Yahusha must return within the lifetime expectancy of those born before or during World War II, which was fought between 1939 and 1945. With the exception of South and Central America, World War II was a global event, the first of its kind. The First World War, by comparison, was a European affair. Moreover, Jerusalem, Muhammad al-Husseini, was the author of the Holocaust, which was designed to kill European Jews rather than have them exiled to Judea. And that was part of a similar prophecy, speaking of the Holocaust in Psalm 102. Segment of Shattering Mist today. As we consider the timing, we also find that Yahweh in Psalm 102 spoke prophetically of the Holocaust, which occurred between 1932 and 1945. And he similarly states during that discussion of the Holocaust that the generation which experiences it will be the last. So to determine how long after the Holocaust, World War II, and Israeli statehood, Yahweh's on Yahusha's return will be. And by the way, at this point, there will be no distinction between Yahweh and Yahusha. Right now, the only distinction is that Yahusha has been a diminished corporeal manifestation of Yahweh, but upon his return, there is no diminishment, so there will be no distinction. But anyway, the same generation that witnessed all of these things is going to witness his return. So we certainly can pinpoint it to a reasonable proximity. You can't go more than 100 years past 1945, or you go beyond the lifespan of those who witnessed these things. And prior to that would be more reasonable. So the return is limited to the life expectancy among Jews living in Israel during this time. It is currently 83 years. If you look at the mortality of Jews living in Israel, it would be 83 years. But this number, based on current trends, is expected to reach 88 years over the next decade or so, and we have a little time remaining, 21 years. And the maximum life expectancy, and thus the far extremity of the prophecy of a Jewish person living today, is known to be around 105 to 107 years. Philadelphia resident Herbert Brown, for example, is 105-year-old Jewish Dachau concentration camp survivor, and his 100-year-old wife, Magda, were the oldest living married couple back in 2005. And in October 2007, a Jewish man named Boris celebrated his 107th birthday in a Moscow synagogue. Therefore, we should expect Yahusha and Yahweh to return, to be about 88 to 105 years after 1945, and thus no later than 2033 through 2050. And anything past 2033 is really pushing the envelope. In the context of his return, Yosha's next statement elevates the critical importance of searching Scripture for answers, of recognizing that Yah's word will be fulfilled exactly as it is written. But before that, even in this discussion of the length of a generation, recognize God has told us precisely when he's going to return. I'm just giving you the full extent based upon the generational timeline, but he has played out this human history from our departure from the garden to our reconciliation into the covenant over 6,000 years, with 1,000 years as a celebration of us camping out together. We can put together the timeline. He has just told us that he's going to return on Yom Kippurim. So it is extraordinarily clear that he is going to return on Yom Kippurim in year 6,000 Yah, which is October 2nd at sunset 2033. God says the universe and the earth will disappear, but conversely, my word will not in any way be disregarded. God is telling us where to look if we want to know when he is returning. His word. Nothing he said will be disregarded. Moving on, Matanya's Hebrew rendition of what Yahweh said, Yahusha said, which was then translated into Greek, in his next statement, throws everything into question. Translated twice, at least twice, from Aramaic or Hebrew into Greek and then Greek into English, we find what I'm going to read to you. But recognize that it is highly likely that this conversation occurred by reciting a Hebrew passage, explaining it in Aramaic, and then it was later translated into Greek by someone who was not a witness, and then maintained poorly and into English. This is what Matthew 24:36 now says. But nevertheless, concerning the immediate vicinity of that one specific and definite day and hour, no one recognizes, not the messengers of heaven, only the Father, only the one who exists for all time. Well, when we return to this program tomorrow, we're going to examine that passage because it is one of the most befuddling statements ever recorded. And we're going to look at each of the ways you can consider that statement. And at the end, I will share with you what God actually said as he cited Zechariah.
Many Americans suffer from digestive problems, often totally unaware they're not absorbing essential nutrients from foods and supplements. Dr. Peter Glidden is aware of the importance